public hearing.
I don't want him to do it. One time I was going to
She's already been sued.
So I actually want to.
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, the date is March 8th, 2011. We do not have all our members in the committee at this time, but I think we're going to proceed anyway. We're not going to wait around for a bunch of wayward legislators. Today, members, we have the Department of Public Safety budget overview, and you'll get to meet for the first time Mona Doman, our new public safety commissioner. Mona and I have known each other for, 20 years, I think? And it's kind of unusual that we met at sixth grade 20 years ago. If anyone believes that, they should vote for someone else. Mona Doman was the most recently the police chief in Maple Grove, the city where I represent and live. I've known her for a long time. I think it's one of the best selections that this governor has chosen for a commissioner. And at this point, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much. And I appreciate your comments, Senator Limmer. I share the same sentiments. We've worked together for a long time. I have a huge amount of respect for the work that you do, and I look forward to working with you at this level as well. So thank you. As the chair said, this is day six on the job for me, so I am here to learn as much and also to share a quick overview of the Department of Public Safety for you through the Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison. But I would just like to start out by talking just a little bit about what our mission is at the Department of Public Safety, and ultimately it is to protect and serve the citizens and the communities throughout the state of Minnesota. We prevent, we prepare, we respond, we recover, educate, and enforce laws and rules throughout our state. And we focus on saving lives and providing efficient and effective services throughout our departments and divisions, but also then throughout the state of Minnesota. And utmost is maintaining public trust and developing strong partnerships around the state. And the different divisions within the Department of Public Safety, as you are probably aware, but I'll just share with you, is the State Fire Marshal, the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, and they actually have their conference going on this week here in St. Paul and are working very hard right now to prepare for the spring flooding. And then we have the Office of Justice Programs, the Emergency Communication Networks, and then the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And I am going to now turn it over for the budget summary to our Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison, who is here with me. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Doman, are you going to remain at the table?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, I will remain here.
All right. Deputy Commissioner Ellison, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Public Safety. The governor's budget recommendations for the 12-13 biennium include $327.6 million from all funds. This represents a 6.6% decrease from fiscal year 10-11 to reflect changes to the forecast base as well as budget change items. The budget change items include a request for disaster assistance match, an allocation for the Network for Better Futures, and the armor maintenance and operations request, and I'll get into those in more detail later in the presentation. The 12-13 governor's budget recommends direct appropriations by funds as follows. From miscellaneous special revenue, $26,764,000. State government special revenue, $137,487,000. From the Trunk Highway Fund, $3,882,000. And from the general fund, $159,430,000. So the total of all funds, again, is $327,563,000. The projected expenses for the 12-13 biennium by category include transfers to other agencies or funds of $78,660,000, payments to individuals, $2,734,000, compensation of $69,329,000. Operating expenses, which is everything other than salaries, equipment, and all of that, is $83,546,000. And then assistance to local units of government or not-for-profits is $93,294,000. First of all, within the public safety areas of the Department of Public Safety, we're going to talk a little bit about the State Fire Marshal's Office. And in your budget books, that's located on pages 60 through 67. The mission of the State Fire Marshal Division is to protect lives and property by fostering a fire-safe environment. Their services include investigation, enforcement, regulation, emergency response, data collection, and public education. For the 12-13 biennium, the recommendation for the State Fire Marshal's Office is $8,574,000 from the Fire Safety Account, which is a special revenue fund. Next is the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, and that's located on pages 91 through 97 of your budget. The mission is to maintain the integrity of legalized gambling, detect and vigorously pursue illegal forms of gambling, enforce the state's liquor laws, and monitor the state tribal gaming compacts. They provide alcohol beverage licensing and permitting. They do brand label registration, investigate alcohol-related complaints and investigations of licensed premises, alcohol promotion and advertising regulation, imposition of civil penalties, the enforcement of underage drinking laws, and the retail alcohol vendor enforcement program. In the gambling enforcement area, they do licensing of manufacturers and distributors of gambling equipment, assure compliance with state tribal compacts, gambling criminal enforcement, and investigation. For the 12-13 biennium, the recommendation from the governor is $4.472 million, $3,166,000 of that from the general fund, and $1,306,000 from the special revenue fund. The special revenue monies are derived from the Indian Nation compacts, criminal background fees, and gambling forfeitures. The next division is Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Their mission is to help Minnesota prevent, prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural and human-caused disasters. Their services include emergency preparedness, planning and response, pre-disaster mitigation, post-disaster recovery, critical infrastructure protection, Community Right to Know Act, a school safety center, training exercises and simulations, coordination of statewide and volunteer resources, and they administer a large amount of federal programs. For the 12-13 biennium, the request is for $5.05 million from the general fund, $3,704,000, special revenue, $1,208,000, and the environmental fund, $138,000. As I mentioned before, HSEM is a pass-through for sizable federal dollars. In fiscal year 11, HSEM will expend approximately $28 million in local assistance to over 300 local governments and other entities. One of the change items that we have involves Homeland Security and Emergency Management. It is on page 15 of your budget documents. And this is for disaster recovery. The federal government provides 75% of the costs for disaster recovery, and this is for the spring floods that occurred in 2009. And that leaves 25% as a required state and local match. The recommendation is for $2,043,000 as a deficiency appropriation for the state and local match for the disaster number 1830. This is a one-time request. Next is the Office of Justice Programs, and I'll talk a little bit about this area, talk about their mission and a little bit about their programs, and then I understand you have some specific questions, so I'm going to ask Ms. Jerry Bovera to come forward and answer any of the questions that you have. This program is located on pages 105 to 114 of your budget books. Their mission is to provide leadership and resources to reduce crime in Minnesota, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and assist victims of crime. OJP services include the Crime Victim Reparations Program, Crime Victim Justice Unit, grants to local programs for assistance to crime victims, and those grants are for general crime victims, abused children, battered women, domestic violence programs, sexual assault programs, and an emergency grant program. They also provide training and communication, a statistical analysis center, and justice and community grants to reduce crime, delinquency, drug abuse, and violence. The recommended funding for the Office of Justice Programs for the next biennium is $71.7 million, $71,482,000 from the general fund, and $192,000 from the special revenue fund. In addition to programming, OJP administers state and federal grants to nonprofits and local units of government. I'm going to ask Director Beauvais to come forward and answer any specific questions that you have. Let me just say, too, as she's coming to the table, that there is a change item in this area as well, which is located on page 18. The governor is requesting a one-time appropriation to the Network for Better Futures. It's a comprehensive social societal reentry program working with high-risk men leaving the prison system. The recommendation is for a one-time grant of $2.9 million to expand, complete, and assess a currently operating demonstration pilot program. And we do have people in the audience that can provide more detail on this program if committee members have questions.
Okay. Are there any questions at this time?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Lentz.
Thank you. First of all, congratulations, Commissioner.
Thank you.
I'm proud to have a member of my police department as your husband, so.
Very good.
I did have a question about the Network for Better Futures, and I don't know if you want me to ask that now or if there's some other time.
Senator Lentz, we were hoping for them to give a brief presentation toward the end of our time today, and so probably it would be better just to hold on that until we have their presentation. Then we can ask them any question we want.
Thank you.
Do you have any other questions?
Not at this time.
Director Beauvais, I had a question regarding, if we can go back to page 10 of this handout, the department handout. I think it would be wise for our committee to better understand the OJP services area, and we can start with crime victim reparations. What's been the history of the development of this program, and when do we get involved as a state, and when do we not get involved in a state? Maybe you could give us a little outline and establish some parameters in our mind to understand this service.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jerry Beauvais, and I'm the Director of the Office of Justice Programs. I think, members, you have in your packet a four-page overview of the Office of Justice Programs. And if the chair would allow, I'd like to just go through that, and I'll explain all the programs that are under the Office of Justice Programs as quickly as I can. As Commissioner Ellison indicated, our mission, we have a budget last year a little over $60 million, and that's about 58% general fund, 40% federal funds, and 2% special revenue. I'm honored to work next to 39 unbelievably hardworking, dedicated public servants who are organized in three major activities: crime victim services, law enforcement, and community grants, and training, research, and communication. I'm going to go over the crime victim services programs first. The first, Mr. Chair, is reparations. They provide victims and families direct compensation for losses as a result of violent crime. The expenses can include medical costs, mental health care, funeral and burial costs. The work is overseen by a reparations board, which Senator Harrington actually was our chair for many years, and under his leadership, we implemented many cost-cutting measures. This program had over 1,800 claims last year and put out $2.4 million in claims. Their budget is about 47% general fund, 18% special revenue, including restitution and inmate wages. 34% of their grant or their operating budget is a federal award, which is based on 60% of the state expenses the previous year. So it's a direct match. The next unit is the Crime Victim Justice Unit. They provide information and referral and assistance in navigating the criminal justice system, and they investigate the violation of crime victim rights. Over the last 2 years, they have opened 74 formal cases, provided consultation on dozens more, and had over 2,900 contacts with the public. This small but mighty team of two manages also the Victim Information Notification Every Day, or VINE, system. VINE provides real-time notification to victims on the custody status of offenders in county and local detention facilities. And 94% of the counties in Minnesota who have jails are on this system. Victims can access this system through the phone, a 1-800 number, or through a web activity as well. Over the last 5 years, VINE has had over 50,000 searches by phone and has had over 900,000 online searches. OJP and the Department of Corrections collaborated on a federal grant award to enhance the information referral system for the Department of Corrections. We got the award. And in December, Minnesota Choice, which is an enhancement of victim information notification to VINE, but for offenders who are in the state correctional facility. VINE is supported by a $455,000 general appropriation. OJP has a long history of collaborating with the Department of Corrections, including we support a position at DOC to ensure that there's victim input in all the end of confinement review hearings as required by the community notification law. Both reparations and CVJU have annual reports. They're on our website. I'm happy to provide you more detail than you can imagine on both those programs through those reports. The last program in crime victim services is the grants to local crime victim organizations. The budget for this total federal and state dollars is about $33 million. 22.7 is general fund, 96,000 is special revenue, and 10.4 million is four different federal funds that we integrate together with the state funds and appropriate to 145 organizations around the state who serve crime victims. When I was here last, Senator Harrington asked me about the demand for services. And over the between 2003 and 2010, we have asked for the same demographic and service information from our grantees. And one thing I can tell you about those numbers is that they are very consistent. There's been some slight increases and decreases, and I'll touch on those quickly as we go through the crime programs. The Abused Children Program serves 37 Minnesota counties through community advocacy, parenting time centers, and child advocacy centers. 5% of the overall budget supports these programs. And these numbers, a little over 7,500 children last year, are slightly up. The domestic violence programs, we serve 82 counties through shelter advocacy and criminal justice intervention. In fiscal year 10, we served over 59,000 victims, with just under 10,000 of that number who received some kind of emergency shelter. OJP supports 662 beds and a number of hotel and motels as well in fiscal year 10. 59% of the overall funding goes to support shelter and motel and hotel beds. The 17% goes to non-shelter advocacy programs in the community. The General Crime Victim Program supports services in 60 counties. They served over 28,000 people last year, and they provide support to people who are victims of homicide, assault, and robbery. Just a small point on all crime victims focus on a specialty, but they also serve any crime victim who does come to their door. And consistently over time, about 15% of the general crime folks who have been served are victims of domestic violence. The sexual assault programs, 74 counties have programs, and in fiscal year 10, we served over 12,000 primary and secondary victims, and 11% of the overall budget supports sexual assault services. We also have a small emergency grant program of $150,000. There are small grants of $1,000 to $5,000 that go to 75 agencies to assist crime victims with changes of locks or transportation issues. The next area is the law enforcement and community grants programs. The state-funded programs here are the justice and community or youth-focused crime prevention. This is $1.7 million each year of the biennium. They support prevention and intervention programs in communities to create safety and reduce crime. They served over 11,000 adults and over 10,000 kids last year. The Youth Intervention Program, which I think you had an opportunity to hear from Scott Beatty and a number of those programs, also is in within the department, and that's $1.6 million. They support community-based non-residential programs that provide education, counseling, and referral services to youth and their families. They served over 10,000 people last year. The next state program is the Violent Crime Enforcement Teams. That budget is about $4.4 million each year. This supports 24 task forces around the state. Last year, that resulted in a little over 3,300 arrests. We then have a number of federally funded programs that I'll try to go quickly through so you just know what's in. We have 15 different federal awards in the department or in the Office of Justice Programs. The first is the Burn JAG, and that award in 2009 was $4.9 million. We support law enforcement initiatives, some family dependency courts, the Minnesota School Safety Center, a number of reentry programs, and drug treatment expansion in Faribault. We also administer the juvenile justice programs, which is the Juvenile Accountability Block Grant, Title II, and Title V funding, and these are delinquency programs in the community. We also support a Forensic Science Improvement Grant, a Project Safe Neighborhood Grant that is targeted on reducing crime in Indian Country, and we administer the Residential Substance Abuse Treatment Fund that supports drug treatment in the correctional setting. I then described the American Recovery Act funds that we had, and they came to us through the various programs we have. I have each specific program, I have much more information as well. I can provide you with individual program sheets on each of the programs that I just described if you're interested in seeing those. And last but not least is our training, research, and communications team. This team provides best practices training to criminal justice professionals around the state. We have an annual conference of over 200 folks, multidisciplinary. We support an annual Crime Victim Assistance Academy, and the Statistical Analysis Center provides data analysis, and I think they presented to this committee most recently on the Juvenile Justice System Decision Point Study. That's just a quick recap of the Office of Justice Programs, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Ms. Bouvier? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think now might actually be the appropriate time for the question I had relating to Network for Better Futures, because I don't have a specific question about the operation of the program, but how it fits into OJP's expenditures and grants. There have been a lot of programs over the years that have come through, particularly the Public Safety Budget Division I served on for the last 4 years, seeking grants for their reentry for at-risk clients. And I'm wondering how that fits into the current governor's budget proposal and how Network for Better Futures fits in the context of those other programs as well.
Ms. Bouvier?
Mr. Chair. OJP has had a long history of supporting a variety of reentry programming. We have a participant in the Department of Corrections MCORE project that really targets their efforts toward the metropolitan area. And traditionally, OJP has supported the areas outside the metro area or special populations, women and juveniles. The Network for Better Futures was a recipient of one of the awards that we had under our ARRA funds, and they are a current reentry grantee of ours. So we fund an array of reentry programs within the Office of Justice Programs. I hope that answers your question.
Sir Lapp.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Ms. Boisvert. So what you're suggesting for this change item is not to defund the other reentry programs, some of which, at least from what I gather, serve a lot of the same populations and seem to have some very impressive track records, but would be to supplement with this additional funding to be able to finish up the demonstration project?
Ms. Bouvier?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for being late. I had a bill up in transportation. Maybe this was already asked, but the reentry program, are dollars going out to programmers, jail programmers for that? And also my second question was on the back page, the something that's fairly new to me, American Recovery Act. Those are new dollars. Could you expound on those a little bit? But first, the one I'm wondering about is, do jail programmers, I think that's their function, is the reentry program. Do they fund those?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair.
We do fund, I think, three current jail programs, and they're funded primarily under federal funds as well. I think we fund a program in Winona, one in Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted County as well. The American Recovery Act were the one-time stimulus funds that we received, and they came to us under our regular programs, the JAG program, the Violence Against Women programs, and the Violence Crime Act funds. And they were a one-time an award.
A follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingerbert.
Real quickly, the Burn Justice Assistant Grant on the back page, the JAG, can you give a little better explanation as to how those dollars are dispersed?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Senator, these are generally dispersed through competitive application processes. There are different, generally we put in place a 3 to 5 year plan, and then we have competitive processes under the various categories. So, for example, under the courts area, we have a number of family dependency courts that we're funding. So we put on an RFP for that kind of service, and they make application and they compete.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ms. Bovier, oh, there is? Oh, Senator Harrington, I didn't see you there.
I also apologize for being late, but Ms. Bovier, Commissioner Harry, my friend, do you have a question in terms of...
Senator Harrington, could you pull your microphone in front of you?
Sure. Sorry
there
about
that.
Ms. Bovier, Commissioner Mary Ellison, where is the growth in crime in terms of what are we seeing in terms of actual new victims? Where's the area that we're seeing the greatest frequency?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I would say the increases that we've noted, especially in the reparations program, have been two arenas, and that's domestic violence and child abuse cases.
Follow-up question?
Sure, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Harrington.
Looking at the budget, I'm puzzled given that was the answer, that it appears that we have a $1.8 million reduction in domestic violence funding. Is there an explanation as to if we have more victims of domestic violence, why we would be cutting that particular area of the many areas in OJP?
Ms. Bovier.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in fiscal year 9 and 10, there were successive cuts to the OJP budget. The legislature determined that crime victim services and the youth intervention programs should not be cut more than 3%. In 9 and 1.5% in 10, and that's where the reductions. The size of the domestic violence cut is related to the size of their budget, if that makes any sense to you.
A little bit.
Senator Harrington.
One more follow-up, which is what would be the impact then of that cut to services in terms of actual programs being funded, availability of services to women in the state of Minnesota?
Ms. Bovier.
Senator, clearly services would be reduced or staffing may have to be reduced as well to provide support to victims.
Thank you.
Sarah Marty.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to hear, because I didn't hear the second part of your answer, where the crime victims numbers were going, battered women, and what was the other one?
Ms. Bovier.
Senator, child abuse cases.
Thanks.
Senator Ingrid.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, there was a lot of talk about the Metro Gang Strike Force and the problems they had. Haven't seen anything in the headlines as of late. Is it fair to say that problem has been resolved? And I ask that because I know there's a lot of multi-jurisdictional dollars that you administer out into rural Minnesota and I think some of the suburbs as well. In general, is that running pretty well now?
Ms. Bovier?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we did a comprehensive reassessment, given the issues with the Metro Gang Strike Forces, all the strike forces, or all the task forces, and have significant documentation of the health and the well-being of those task forces. We think they're running very well.
Thank you.
Ms. Bovier, I have a question. Going back to the American Recovery Act of 2009, According to the statement here, the OJP programs received $21 million in funding through three federal formula grants. Does that funding expire soon, or was that only for 2009? Could you give me a little idea of where we are on funding on that?
Mr. Chair, those funds expire, I think it's 9/30/2012. And when we put out the competitive applications for these, we received, for the $21 million, we received $180 million, I think, in requests. What we ended up doing is doing two-year grant awards and granted the entire amount of money out to the communities.
Ms. Wolver, did we as a state need to provide matching funds for the $21 million?
Mr. Chair, we had to provide match for just the violence against women dollars. That was the only program that required match.
Do you remember what that dollar amount was?
I can look. I think I'd have to get you that information,
right,
Mr. Chair.
All right. Another question that I had, if I can go back to page 2. Going down to the bottom of the page on law enforcement and community grants, what would be the difference between the justice grants, community and youth-focused crime prevention, versus YIPA? Could you tell me how is the funding defined, who qualifies and who does not,
Mr. Chair,
in comparison to one another?
The YIPA funds were really established 30 years ago to provide ongoing funding to prevention and intervention programs around the state, specifically targeting this at-risk population with specific services. Those funds, for every dollar we give them, the community has to generate $2. So it's been a very stable source of funding for prevention programming around the state. The justice and community grants are competitive every 2 years, and the difference is while most of the dollars do end up supporting youth programming, community groups can also apply for this grant fund as well. So, for an example, the Minneapolis High Rise Association is an applicant to provide support services for the elderly.
And, Ms. Bovera, what are those services exactly?
Mr. Chair, the services, they do crime prevention workshops, they do escort services, they try to do an analysis of the safety of their buildings. They actually do some crime victims referral as well in this particular project.
Now, in the programs that you said were started 30 years ago, is that the justice grants? That's the youth intervention programs?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Now, tell me, they were for at-risk populations. Are they still at-risk populations from 30 years ago, or does that money... Is it moved around, or I am always asking, anytime anybody gives me a 30-year-old program, I'm going to ask, is the mission 30 years ago as relevant then as it is today?
Mr. Chair, these programs joined OJP in 2003, and when they joined us, we offered a new competitive process and implemented a new evaluation component to ensure that the dollars were targeted to the young people that they were designed to serve.
Pardon me. I've never seen the evaluation process. Maybe you could send me a note on it or review with that some other day. But I would like to know the evaluation process. We might learn something from it ourselves. Any other questions? Oh, Sarah Lance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ingebrigtsen prompted me a follow-up regarding the gang strike force stuff. This committee in the past served an important accountability and oversight role with regard to the issues that appeared in the media and the difficulties that the gang strike force had. And I wonder if there's any follow-up report or documentation, because I know the department was looking at restructuring its relationship and its oversight responsibilities with regard to the various gang and drug task forces. And I wonder if this committee intends to receive have a hearing or anything, any testimony, get an update on where all of that is so that we can assure the public and can be assured ourselves that there's confidence in the task forces. I think it's important, for the effectiveness of law enforcement as much as for any other purpose.
Lats, I don't know if that's a question for me or Ms. Beauvais.
Maybe both. I
don't know. Well, Ms. Bovary, you're first.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that opportunity. We'd be happy to provide significant documentation of the work that we've done to restructure, as well as the assessments we've done on every task force. And if you'd like a presentation, we'd be happy to provide that as well.
Thank you, Ms. Bovary. And as for me, I think we're going to analyze that question as we analyze our budget to see where we go and what direction we are at. We kind of closed the book on that last year. I know you're new to the committee, Senator Latz, but we had a lot of discussion a year and perhaps even a little bit before a year ago when the events of the gang strike force came relevant in news stories. And we had a lot of coverage on that. We had task force of legislators following up on judicial committee hearings on it and reviewed the whole process. Then it kind of went into a dormant phase because we were waiting for the FBI to finish an investigation. I believe they did finish the investigation, but they did not direct any prosecution in that. And from that point, I think the issue has kind of remained dormant in this committee. And I think it's the best judgment for us is once we begin to develop and finalize our budget targets, we can revisit that if we as a committee decide to go into that direction and continue that life again. Any other questions? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, has the new commissioner been questioned? I'm sorry, again, I was late. Have you had questions?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, we were waiting for you to question the new commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I've been waiting, Senator, too, as well.
No, I really have no questions. Just welcome. Welcome to St. Paul. And I've had the opportunity to work with her not on a whole lot of issues, but... Commissioner, you graduated from Alexandria Technical College, did you not?
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I did.
I just wanted to make that point that a lot of tremendous practitioners in law enforcement, tremendous law enforcement practitioners graduated from the Alexandria Technical College, and she's one of them.
You know,
along
Senator,
with many others, I might say.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, they may get educated in your town, but they eventually end up living in mine.
You certainly get corrupted down here, there's no question. You live in northern Minnesota, don't you?
Northern suburbs. Any other questions? While we have a number of representatives from the Department of Public Safety, I know that the committee has some discussions regarding the emergency preparations for the spring. Is there anyone that could give us a little idea of where we are on that? And
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could ask Director Chris Eide to come forward, right, the division director, and she can give an update on where we're at.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Chris Eide, and I'm the Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. And as you can imagine, your communities are very busy in preparing for the spring floods. We will have record or near-record floods this season on the Red River, the Minnesota River, and the Lower Mississippi River, including the city of St. Paul, could be over the 1965 levels. The communities have been busy in their own towns looking at the levels of rivers and the trigger points that we've asked them to look at this year, and what facilities are at risk, how many people are at risk at particular river levels, and what types of resources they may need when the flooding comes into town. We've been working with the federal government, including the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, to pre-deploy resources and to request advanced measures from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to do clay diking, to do some other protective measures that need to be done, particularly before the thaw of the spring, because the way that they need to transport certain items, we can't have it on spongy ground, so we have to do things before the thaw. We have been making meetings. We have had six meetings where the governor, local legislators, city council members, mayors, county boards have been meeting about their areas of concern, about the mitigation efforts that they have been undertaking and have on their plans. And we feel very confident that we are ready for the spring. We understand everybody's roles and responsibilities, and that we are working together as a team. As Commissioner Dolman mentioned, over 400 of them right now are at the Crown Plaza for our annual conference. They are going through training anywhere from improvised explosive devices to recovery programs on how to use our new electronic grants package. And they are all in the back of their minds, back in their communities, as they are learning more about their profession. They're still back in their communities, making sure that they are getting ready for the spring floods, which we anticipate will kick off in a couple, 3 weeks now.
Any questions? Commissioner, Minnesota is a state that I don't know how many miles tall it is on the map, but because of its great distance from north to south, I would imagine that most of the thawing will occur in the southern part of the state first moving forward. But do you anticipate that there'd be an impact all the way across the state at any given time where it's really taxing our resources?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if we see when we look back at history and the weather patterns that we have been seeing this year that compare to 1965 and 1997, we do have the thaw that usually comes in the southern part of the state first. So as we are as we're fighting the flood there, we're continuing to prepare in the north. We will be in recovery in the south as we are in response in the north. So with the state agency assistance, with volunteer assistance, with mutual aid across the state, with the Minnesota National Guard still having about 11,000 soldiers and airmen available to help as needed, and as part of the Emergency Management Assistance Compact with 50 states and 4 of the 6 territories, we feel that we will have the resources necessary to fight the flood.
Any other questions? Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, I'm taking this in a slightly different direction. You mentioned that some of the 400 students are studying at the Crown Plaza, and you mentioned improvised explosive devices. Can you give us any information in regards to either the threat of narco-terrorism or the threat of international terrorism in the state of Minnesota?
Commissioner Eide.
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, we are always assessing the risk of terrorism in the state. We have raised our profile across the country in this last assessment for the terrorism risk. We are part of several groups that look at our critical infrastructure and look at protecting our infrastructure and working with our federal partners in Customs and Border Protection, Transportation Security Administration, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and we feel that if we continue to train at the local level and equip at the local level and make sure that we are connected information-wise with the federal government and with other states through our fusion center, that we have a pretty good handle on where we sit with our threat.
Follow-up question? Mr. Chairman, one of the issues that came up in the last couple of years was the status of MNJAC, Minnesota Joint Information Center. Can you speak to that? There was discussion about really creating a true fusion center linking Minneapolis, St. Paul, the major counties with MNJAC more thoroughly, and I wasn't sure whether that had ever been followed up on and kind of what the status on that was.
Director Ide.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Harrington, I think that I'll actually defer that question to Dave Bjerga of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The MNJAC was put under their management, I think, a year before, and so they really are the managing entity for the MNJAC at this point. So.
Is Mr. Bjerga? Welcome to the committee.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Could you identify yourself for the record?
My name is Dave Bjerga, and I'm the acting superintendent for the Minnesota BCA.
Okay. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the MNJAC has expanded its capabilities they've taken on more analysts. They've taken on a training role that they didn't have before, providing training and online training. We're currently in the process of looking at how to better tie the CISA, which is the Hennepin County Analysis Center, along with the Ramsey County unit, and then Dakota County is also on board. And we're currently just in the last meeting within the last couple of weeks starting to research how to better make MNJAC the collector and disseminator of this information, both in the information world, criminal information world, and then also the Homeland Security piece. So that is moving forward, and we're not where we want to be yet, but we're continuing to move forward.
Sir Harrington?
Just a quick follow-up. Is there a timeline as to when you will be where you want to be? And if you could help maybe describe that a little bit more fully as to what that would look like when we get there.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the timeline, it's difficult to say right now because we just now formed a committee of those agencies I mentioned in order to work with MNJAC and also the FBI. MNJAC, a lot of their time has been spent in making sure that they're complying with the regulations that come out of D.C. with DHS. And so I'm hoping that, not hoping, I think that as a group, as a policy group member for the MNJAC, by the end of this year that we would have a framework for these different groups to a framework to collect the information, to analyze the information, and to get the information into the hands of the people that need it. So I'm hopeful that by the end of this calendar year that we would have at least a framework in place for that.
Just one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Expanding from notifying law enforcement agencies and public safety agencies in the state of Minnesota to a slightly broader regional picture, what's MNJAC's relationship with our bordering states? And I know we have a great and a robust relationship with our federal agencies, but I'm wondering about Bureau of Information or investigations out of Iowa, Wisconsin, as criminal enterprises and terrorist activities cross state lines. How are we positioned to respond?
We're positioned very well in that. Excuse me, sir, Mr. Chair, Senator. We're positioned very well in that regard. Mike Bosacker, who is the director of our MNJAC, serves on several committees, one of which involves the Midwest region of fusion centers. And they're in communication constantly. There's a lot of information sharing between the different states. So as far as where we're at with surrounding states, we're very well positioned. Mike has worked very hard in that regard.
Thank you.
Okay. Director, my question is under the BCA, what is the workload of the BCA at this time? We're in analyzing budgets. We're trying to figure out where our demand is. What's the workload of the BCA at this time?
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty broad question. We have the four divisions of BCA with the investigations, which includes general investigations and narcotics. We have the forensic laboratory. We have our training unit, and then we also have MNJIS, which is our information center. The workload of the BCA in investigations has increased, I think, in the last couple of years. It depends. For our agency, a lot of it depends on the number of agents that we have at any one time. And currently we have, I've been with the agency 21 years, and we currently have the lowest number of agents that we've had in the last 21 years. We have those agents positioned in 10 field offices around the state, and they work very closely with the locals. Our workload in greater Minnesota has stayed fairly consistent, and in the metro area it's actually picked up somewhat in general investigations. The laboratory is always seen to be increasing with the numbers of evidence, the amount of evidence being submitted. The DNA in particular, in which different crimes or different persons are supposed to be submitting DNA. There's a lot of analysis in that regard. So the crime lab is always under some stress when it comes to workload. And I don't see that workload lessening anytime soon. Our training section was recently reorganized within the last couple of years, and that's just now ramping up. We provide training to state police officers, and that's also expanded its capabilities and the offerings of the classes. And then with MNJIS CrimNet reorganization, they have multiple projects currently ongoing, and if there were any budget cuts in their area, we would most likely have to, in their terminology, put some of those projects in the parking lot. To sum it up, sir, I don't see that our workload in any of our areas is going to be lessened anytime soon.
Director, is there any increase in recent crime that is beginning to spike a little bit more, or is it an overall increase on all fronts?
The crimes that I'm seeing at the BCA, I heard the testimony earlier, but something that I would like to add to that as far as spiking would be financial crimes and identity theft. That's really, we have a financial crimes task force, which is under the direction of the commissioner, and that's really an area that we do need some support in. We need some backing. The financial crimes task force is made up of federal agencies and then six local affiliates. The BCA have also put in resources with two agents and also the commander. But the interesting part about the financial crimes task force is that so much of what the financial crimes task force does and the people that it's targeting are also involved in other criminal activities. We have task forces against gangs. We have task forces against narcotics, immigration, whatnot, juvenile prostitution. In every one of those categories, if you follow the money, they're going to have some nexus to the financial crimes task force, and we really see that as the future here, is to strengthen the financial crimes task force. There's as much work as we would ever want out there in financial crimes. We've partnered with the Secret Service, with the FBI, with the IRS, the Postal, and we get resources from the feds, but it's not really that well funded from the state side, and we're doing what we can with the amount of dollars that we have. And frankly, I think that is the future. And if you talk about a spike in crime, it's the identity theft and the financial crimes.
Right. Senator Harrington.
Mr. Chair, a quick question on predatory offenders. I know the BCA has a role in keeping records on the almost 23,000 predatory offenders that are in the state of Minnesota. How secure should we feel about it in terms of BCA knowing where those offenders are and the relationship in terms of local units of government working on maintaining control over these some of our most dangerous offenders.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think the public can feel very secure from our perspective as far as the registration piece. We have approximately 16,000 active registrants, and we have an approximately 7% non-compliant rate. And half of that 7% are folks that have moved out of state, of which we no longer have jurisdiction over. So our compliance rate in the state of Minnesota is actually very high. And we have, in our group, we have a unit of predatory offender investigators, which work with local agencies on education and also occasionally doing sweeps and finding noncompliant offenders. We've also partnered with the Marshals Service, and they also are a big help to us to locate noncompliant offenders. From our perspective, I think that the citizens are being served very well from the registration point of view.
Mr. Harrington.
One quick follow-up to that. In regards to those that are noncompliant, one of the issues from St. Paul and from the metro area has been on noncompliant sex offenders who are predatory offenders who are homeless. I'm just wondering how the BCA is handling that growing issue.
Mr. Chair, I have the individual, the SAC that runs the predatory offender unit, and if I could have him address that question, I think you'd understand the response better.
All right.
It'd be special agent in charge, Eric Knudsen.
Agent Knudsen, welcome to the committee. Could you identify yourself for the record?
Eric Knudsen, Special Agent in Charge of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension Crimes Against Persons Unit.
Senator Harrington, would you want to repeat that question?
Sure. Mr. Knudsen, my question was in regards to the impact of homeless predatory offenders, especially in the metro area, and how the BCA was responding to that growing trend.
Special Agent.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Harrington, we addressed this as a very significant issue a few years ago with the legislative body here, and what we required at that time was a weekly check-in process from those homeless offenders, and it's the one component of our database where we actually allow local law enforcement to have data entry right into our system, as we require the homeless offenders throughout the state to report on a weekly check-in basis to the local law enforcement, and as the offenders check in with their local law enforcement then is able to update our POR database to reflect their compliance with the statute.
Thank you.
Senator, no other questions?
No.
Senator Newman.
Oh, wait.
You'll wait? All right. Any other further questions? Have any? Is Mr. Whitehead here?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Whitehead is here.
I'd like to get an idea of where we are with the Armor radio programming. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Ron Whitehead. I'm the acting director of the Emergency Communication Networks.
You've been here before.
Yes, I have.
So thanks for coming back. I was wondering if you could give us an upgrade or an update on where we are with our Armor funding and the development, the interoperability, all of those issues.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Armor program, obviously, as you know, is the statewide build-out of a trunked radio system across the state. In 2005, we funded outside of the metropolitan area, what we call Phase 3. Then in 2007, the legislature funded us to complete the system. It's a cooperative effort between the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation. Department of Transportation actually owns the radio system and is in the process of constructing that. And then we have the statewide radio board that provides the policy and direction with respect to operational and technical standards of the radio system. At the present time, we're approximately 60% complete with the Armor system, and we're completed to the point where MnDOT has actually transitioned fully over to the Armor system across the state. In other words, they have statewide coverage. Better one than they used to have with their old VHF system. And the State Patrol will be transitioning to that system this summer, so that statewide, the Minnesota State Patrol will be operating off the armor system. As part of this process, we've been working very actively through the 7 regional radio boards that were developed in conjunction with the statewide radio board. And we have approximately 70 to 71 counties that have indicated that they need to go or they want to go onto the armor system. That's all being driven by the fact that in 2013, the FCC has mandated that VHF, the traditional radio systems that we had, a few of them were UHF, be narrow-banded, in essence obsoleting all the old radio equipment that exists in throughout the state and requiring not only the state but local units of government to look at a new radio system of some nature, either a traditional VHF in a narrow-band realm or going on to the armor system. And we've been very, very successful at working through, like I say, the regional radio boards. And helping the local communities to understand what their options are and selecting an alternative. That alternative being the armor system that's selected the most often, providing the highest level of interoperability technically. When we're all operating on a shared standard open system, we have the ability to talk to each other selectively when we need to reorganize amongst interoperability talk groups. In addition to that, in 2005, I believe, no, 2007, we funded a statewide interoperability coordinator. Tom Johnson in our office is actually the statewide interoperable program coordinator, and we have 3 interoperability coordinators that operate throughout the state, working with the regional radio boards and local counties as they talk about how do we put this operational side of interoperability. We've done the technology. I mean, we're on the way to have the technology in place. Now we're working on the operational side of how do we do it operationally to make sure that people are able to use that system to maximize the interoperability between public safety workers. I'm glad to say, along with, you talked earlier with Chris Eide, the director of Division of Homeland Security Emergency Management, the armor system, again, having a statewide footprint at the present time will be instrumental in providing communications throughout the state with respect to flooding. I know up in the Fargo-Moorhead area that although they're on a VHF system, that we've made some strides and do have a radio coverage there where we're using the armor system. The National Guard has actually come to us for some additional radios so that when they work up there, they can work on the armor system to assure continuity of communications and so forth. So I'm glad to say that we're on track. We're in our budget, within our budget, to complete the project except for about 20 towers. It's 328 towers. By December 30th of 2012, we should have approximately 315 of those towers up and operational, have a system that provides 95% mobile coverage within every county of the state and be available to all local agencies, and in addition have interoperability fixes with those that stay on their legacy communication systems.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Whitehead, for the report. The E-911 services, can you tell me how many dollars have been going out there on a statewide on an average every year? To the local units of government?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, approximately $13.5 million is allocated to the PSAPs out of the E-911 fund. That's done on a formula that's statutory, where it's one half is determined by the number of PSAPs, and then one half of the amount is distributed by population. When the new census comes in, we'll redo that formula in accordance with the statute. But it's stayed at approximately 13.5 for, I think, the last 3 or 4 years.
Follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Whitehead, and maybe I'm not sure who could answer this, but I'm following up on constituent who said that the armor system in general is going to be going under the, or there's a bill maybe in the legislature to deal with armor, changing directions of administration. Do you know anything about that?
Director Whitehead.
Sure, I'm familiar with it. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe you're talking about the redundant technology bill. At one point it made reference to the statewide radio board taking that under its for OET to take control of that system and so forth. I believe the statewide radio board's been pulled out of that. My understanding is at this point there may be a study to look at it. I would assure the committee that we've previously looked at that That issue in 2007, the legislation that funded the armor system required us to see if there was an appropriate place that maybe armor, which really is a system owned by the state, the MnDOT, should be placed under OET. Based on that study, it said, no, it's working well where it's at. The public safety department represents the public safety workers or community, and that MnDOT has the experience with building a radio system, not a computer system. So there is some confusion with respect to that bill. It from time to time, it's made mention to the statewide radio board taking a look at that issue. But I believe the last I heard is the statewide radio board was pulled out of that redundant technology bill as being actually on target to be moved over to OET, Office of Office of Enterprise Technology.
Senator Ingerbritz.
Thank you. And so what I'm hearing then is you're good with what's going on so far then. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would submit to the the authors that we've looked at the issue as far as the statewide radio board being aligned with OET. OET is represented on the committee, but as far as being studied again, we've got no concern or fear about that.
Director Whitehead, this reminds me, I saw a budget allocation in a state government or state government finance committee listing armor as one of their budget responsibilities. That was Senator Perry's committee. And he is, I don't think he's involved with Department of Transportation funding either. It's in a different committee. So we're all kind of looking at this and trying to make sure it gets in the right spot. And we'll be following up. I know I talked with Mr. Turner, our finance analyst as well, and he assures me we'll get it in the right spot by the end of this budget cycle. So we're... Some of us have a few questions on where the appropriate spot, or what is the priority for Department of Public Safety to be involved in that finance line or not, and we just want to make sure that we adequately resource public safety if that's going to be their responsibility.
Mr. Chair, if I might comment on
sure.
that too, and
yeah.
give a little bit of history. In 2003, when I started with Department of Public Safety is when the 911 program came over from the Department of Administration. As far as I know, the budget with respect to 911 has been in public safety since that time. I would assure you that it's where it belongs now. We have taken communications to a much broader role of involvement with all the public safety disciplines. And Department of Public Safety is able to provide that continuity between the technology and the operational side of all these, you know, all these systems like 911, next generation 911, public safety communications. There's a chart that's used quite frequently by the federal government on interoperability. It's called the interoperability continuum, and it's kind of interesting to see that the technology side, in other words, the 911 network, the radio system, armor, and so forth, are really just a very small part of making a public safety response. And it's the governance, it's the standard operating procedures, it's the training, the exercise, and the usage that make these things work for us. Mm-hmm. That's exactly one of the reasons why I would say that armor, as a radio system, it doesn't quite fit into OET anyway. But the technology is just a small part of making it work as a public safety response. So I would feel very strongly that the budget, the technology, and the operational side belong in these public safety committees. And to put them back into the technology committees, admin was in the commerce committee before and so forth, would be a sincere mistake in losing that gravity between the operational side of using these things and making sure that the operational people are involved in their development so that we can use them when we need to, when the floods come, when the bridges collapse, that they are truly an asset that provides that response.
Okay. Sir Harrington.
Actually, you just answered my question. I wanted to make the point about how important the training and the exercising is to making interoperability more than just a new radio to put on a belt or a new gadget to put in a car. Having gone through both the training as we went to an 800 megahertz system and a new PSAP, and then having to exercise it both at the 35W bridge collapse and during the RNC, I can tell you that it was the training and it was the pre-work, the policy work that went in there before we actually got the radios that really made that effort possible. So thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? I think we're going to move on to the Network for Better Futures. And if a representative from that organization would come forward. Mr. Steve Thomas is the Executive Director. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we may, I'd like to introduce Makram Alameen on my right. He's one of our life coaches, Vincent Lisi. That's my old high school roommate. Vincent Britton's one of our crew chiefs, and we have a crew of workers here in the audience with us today. If I may, Mr. Chair, I'd just like to take a few minutes to briefly explain who we are, what we've accomplished, and why we believe this is a compelling investment for the state moving forward into the next biennium. The network is beginning its fourth year of operation. It's received support from the legislature over the past two bienniums, and the governor, as is reflected in the budget, is requesting an additional $2.9 million of one-time funding for the upcoming biennium. We've attracted this bipartisan support because we are just demonstrating a very effective way to reduce the financial and social cost of high-risk adults, primarily African-American men, with histories of incarceration, substance abuse, mental illness, chronic unemployment, and homelessness. Since 2008, which is our first year of full operation, we've served over 430 high-risk men. And last year, here are some key statistics from our work. 75% of men who were active in the network last year were employed, and that's against a typical employment rate of almost zero for this population. 75% of our men who owe child support paid their child support. That's against an existing rate of about 15% in child support payments. Most of our men who were enrolled were connected to a medical home, and they received physical exams. They were connected to the primary health care system, and they all received behavioral health assessments. Again, this is significant because this population typically only accesses health care when they have acute illnesses or have been injured in violence or life on the streets. All of our men had access to safe housing and drug treatment, and they were connected to job training services. And perhaps most important for this committee, less than 10% of our men who were active for 90 more days returned to prison for committing a new felony. We estimate that we've generated, for every dollar invested in our endeavor, we've generated at least $3 in benefits for the state and the community at large. Our model briefly consists of five key components: immediate access to safe, affordable housing, short-term work if you need a job, access to primary health care, as I mentioned earlier, access to behavioral health services, including treatment for substance abuse and mental illness, and a community experience consisting of quality relationships and personal accountability. Our social innovation interrupts an expensive cycle of reincarceration and failure that this population currently experiences. Moreover, current practices reinforce a dependency on government services and undermine personal responsibility. Our endeavor helps the state save money. We create new jobs, and under the approach that is recommended in the governor's proposal, we want to be held accountable for saving the state money, creating those new jobs, and achieving much better results. And if we don't meet some of these expectations, we're willing to pay a financial penalty. We encourage this committee to appropriate the $2.9 million for the next biennium so we can complete our five-year pilot, demonstrate proven strategies for reducing spending, and for controlling future costs. More important, during these times of fiscal distress, we want to be held accountable for the following outcomes. First, we want to document that we're generating savings across multiple agencies. We want to be held accountable for creating at least 12 new full-time equivalent job slots for this chronically unemployed population, and that will employ roughly 50 different men annually. We want to prove that we can save the state more than is invested in this endeavor, and we are prepared to complete an independent evaluation to document that evidence. And we want to earn the state's investment, as I mentioned earlier. We want to be paid to perform, and if we don't meet certain outcomes, we'll pay a financial penalty. So thank you for considering this request. We'd be happy to entertain any questions.
Mr. Thomas, you made a comment saying that you're willing to pay a financial penalty if you do not achieve your results.
Yes,
could you expand on that?
Mr. Chair, and we have a model like this being developed now both in other communities. So it's similar to how health care reimbursement occurs in some cases in this state. So if you pay us a fixed rate of $100, withhold $10 of that. And at the end of a period, if in the case that we're recommending, if our men weren't housed, if they weren't working, or if they returned to prison for a new crime, we don't get that $10. So that's the financial penalty we would incur. The other key is that we have to enroll and serve the high-risk men prescribed with the purchaser. So we can't be cherry-picking. We can't take whoever we would like. We want the state should expect to maximize its return on investment, and you do that by serving some of the highest risk people, meaning people who are most likely to reoffend. That's how we get the biggest return financially and socially.
Yeah. Sir Harrington.
Mr. Chairman, my question was on it's a $2.9 million appropriation for 1 year, is that right, or is it 2 years, or?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Thomas.
Senator Harrington, it's $2.9 million for the biennium, so over a two-year period.
By my math, you serve about 400 clients a year, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Harrington, with that funding, we would be enabled to serve about 340 people over the two-year period.
Or about $4,000, $4,500 per client, is that?
It comes out roughly to about $47 a day per diem. And that's about half the rate of incarceration, and that's also for a time-limited basis. The maximum amount of time we would provide any rental assistance or coaching for the men would be 24 months.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we going to hear from some of the folks that are in the program? I'd like to.
Sure. Who wants to volunteer? Stephen, why don't you come on up? Now I'm going to get this because the five other guys are going to be upset that they didn't have a chance to say something.
Welcome to the committee. Could you introduce yourself?
My name is Stephen Hernandez, and I'm with Network Better Futures.
Go ahead.
My name is Steve Hernandez, and I'm a five-time repeat offender. And this last time, when I was sentenced, they labeled me a career criminal, and that really made me think about my life, and if you know that's what I wanted to be for the rest of my life was a career criminal. And so it really made me think, and I made a decision to change my life. And I spent the last 5.5 years in prison trying to better myself through programs like IFI, which is a Christian-based program with intense treatment, and CIP, Challenge Incarceration Program, and which has intense treatment. And in doing so, I built a confidence about myself. And shortly after release, I realized that I had no clue about what I was doing. Times changed. I had no clue how to fill out applications, how to get around in Minneapolis, which I'm new to. With Network for Better Futures, with my life coach, who is Mr. McCrom, and other life coaches, they've helped me to slow down, to think about things more clearly, to do things like resumes, which I had no clue how to fill out. They've directed me into different areas, like workforce centers, places like Amicus, Basilica, places which will help me. And they've made it clear to me that they're not going to do things for me, but they're going to lead and guide me and direct me on how to do those things for myself. So.
Wait, introduce yourself real quick.
Hello, my name is Arch Miguel Murphy, and I too am in the program for Network for Better Futures. I too was incarcerated several times, and I've joined the program, Network for Better Futures, and I learned to appreciate the program because they've given me a lot of help. I do have a previous experience as far as working. I have had several jobs, but I was incarcerated recently. But once I came home, I came to the Network for Better Futures, and I too, Mr. McCrum is my life coach, and he's helped me out in a lot of different areas as far as learning how to seek more and get more in depth into as far as finding jobs and doing what I need to do, you know, and my paperwork and stuff like that. So it's I appreciate the Network for Better Futures because they've helped me out in a lot of different ways. I'm also seeking my crane operator's license, and I'm trying to do that in the process right now, but I too am in a treatment facility where I've been going for several months, and I've learned that for as far as me being in that treatment facility, I learned that I don't need to do those things anymore. You know, I need to just let it go, and I need to be a more productive citizen. And from what I've learned from the Network for Better Futures, I'm on that pathway to better my life and to be, you know, a more productive person.
Mr. Chair, just to follow
up.
What kind of work do you folks do? What kind of jobs did you end up getting or are you looking for?
Well, for me, I'm looking for maybe a warehouse job or something in the shipping and receiving area. I've done a lot of that in the past. I'm also a floor tech specialist. I've done floors over the years for Sears and Roebuck for a couple of years, maybe about 2.5 years. I did it for Sears and Roebuck. I can do a lot of different things.
What did you do today? Tell them what you did.
Oh, well, today I did we had this project for books. We do books for the Network for Better Futures, and we're unloading 30,000 books for Network for Better Futures. And we got in a good majority of them, you know, out of the store. The gentleman called and wanted to give us the books, and we were emptying the store out for the books and stuff. So,
if I may, Mr. Chair, what we do is then we have four men who sort those books, and we're selling them either online or shipping them to a thrifty bookseller. So all of our lines of business are meant to generate revenue, not only create jobs for the men, but if anybody has books, we need 30,000 books a week to start breaking even on this.
Mr. Thomas, your program seems like it would be more of an extension of the Department of Corrections rather than the Department of Public Safety. Do you know why you're allocated into a Department of Public Safety?
Mr. Chair, first of all, our single
division.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Our single largest source of funding this biennium is from the Office of Justice Programs through federal grant. Also, I think, as Ms. Bovaire alluded to earlier, that that has been an office where, and if you look at the federal level, the Office of Justice Programs is the big reform agent for public safety reform, not just around reentry, but around a variety. So that's one rationale for the fit. The other is we don't fit exactly in one place. We're generating a lot of benefits over in the healthcare side. I said in 2009, three of our participants had strokes, and our average age is 34. I mean, the high rates of chronic, some of the hypertension, diabetes, untreated mental illness, substance abuse. So there's a high level of health and behavioral health intervention here. The employment, this year we're currently getting funding from DEED, we're getting funding from housing. So I think, so where is the best target? And I think given their breadth and their history in this case, it's best fit for OJP to finish out our pilot.
Mr. Thomas, you made mention that you're seeking financial help from DEED as well as other government agencies. Could you give me an inventory of how much money total you're seeking from state government?
Mr. Chair, the $2.9 million. I alluded to that's it. The deed amount I mentioned is where we currently receive some one-time funding. In this current biennium, we receive funding from some state funding from deed. And do you want me to give that full accounting for the current biennium?
You could send it to our committee or send it to my office, and we'll continue looking that over. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Thomas, impressive program. What about when people are done with the program? Where are they finding jobs? Because I know inmates, ex-offenders have real trouble getting jobs. Where are they finding jobs? Or is that the biggest problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator Mr. Marty, that and the housing. So that's why we have both available right away. About at any one time, about half our men are working with private employers. And those are typically in the entry-level, low-wage kinds of jobs. We took a big hit when the economy went south and construction went down because that was a popular area. Mm-hmm. Something that is happening, and it's very slow, and the men can – it's very frustrating. But as our reputation's out there and employers understand that we're credible – and we've had situations where an employer will hire our crews and they'll say, hey, so-and-so, that's a good worker. Can we hire them? So just in the last 2 weeks, we've had two employers call us and say, hey, I've got a laborer job open or I've got a warehouse job open. Those are the typical kinds. But it's mostly the men, and they hear this from me all the time. You've got to be knocking on 10 to 15 doors every day, and you go back and keep knocking and keep knocking. That's probably the biggest struggle.
It's an impressive program.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe you answered that. Mr. Thomas, could you tell me, with regards to the key goals and measures in your budget here, this $3.9 million will leverage $3.4. Did you mention that? What those dollars, where those dollars come from?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Senator, I thought it's $2.9.
Yeah.
Okay. The 3.4 are two main sources. One is earned income from our jobs enterprise. So last year we earned $460,000, so that gets plowed back. That helps support part of our operating costs. We're projecting that earned income this coming year will be $600,000 and about an equal total the following year. And then the rest is private funding. We have a large private grant from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is being used to help in a big way to support the development of our business enterprise. They are also funding the independent evaluation that I mentioned earlier, and they cover some of our overhead costs. So those are the two biggest numbers.
Thank you.
Sources.
Senator Murray.
Mr. Chairman, on that last point that Robert Wood Johnson's funding, is it because they are seeing the health care savings? Because that's their focus always.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, yes. They look at this, and this goes back to earlier, where do we fit? They're looking at this through a public health lens. And we know there's huge cost in the criminal justice system, both in terms of the victims and in terms of the criminals. But there's equally unsustainable spending going on the healthcare side and on the behavioral health side. So they clearly see the connection between this high-risk population at this moment in time coming out of prison, going back to a community, living an unstable, unhealthy life, and that has huge costs for society and for budgets.
Any other questions?
Very impressive. Yeah, I just want to.
Senator Goodwin.
I just want to congratulate those of you who came here today and told your story, and also those that are in the audience, because I think you're right on the right track, and let's hope it works. The program works for you. But congratulations for pulling it together enough to get yourselves into the kinds of help that you need to stay out of trouble. And good deal.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you for the time. We appreciate it.
I don't believe there's any other business before the committee. The committee is adjourned.